Chapter 62. Sariputta's Roar. When the retreat season ended, Venerable Sariputta bid farewell to the Buddha before traveling to spread the Dharma. The Buddha wished him a calm and safe journey, and a body and mind free of all cares. He said he hoped Sariputta's efforts to spread the Dharma would not meet with too many obstacles. Venerable Sariputta thanked the Lord and then departed. That noon, a bhikkhu came to the Buddha and complained of being mistreated by Sariputta. He said, "I asked Venerable Sariputta where he was going. He refused to answer me, and in fact pushed me out of his way so hard that I was knocked to the ground. He made no apology, but continued on his way." The Buddha turned to Ananda and said, "I do not think Sariputta will have traveled too far yet. Send one of the novices after him. Tonight we will hold a community meeting in Jetta Dharma Hall." Ananda did as the Buddha asked, and by late afternoon, Venerable Sariputta had returned to the monastery with the novice. The Buddha told him, "Sariputta, tonight the entire community will meet in the Dharma Hall. A bhikkhu has accused you of knocking him to the ground without apologizing." That afternoon, Venerables Moggallana and Ananda visited all corners of the monastery to announce the evening meeting. They said, "You are invited to attend a meeting in the Dharma Hall tonight. Tonight, Brother Sariputta will have a chance to offer his lion's roar." Not one bhikkhu was absent from the hall that evening. Everyone wanted to see how Sariputta would respond to those who had for so long begrudged his position in the Sangha. Venerable Sariputta was one of the Buddha's most trusted disciples, and because of that, he was the object of much misunderstanding and jealousy. Some of the bhikkhus felt the Buddha placed too much trust in Sariputta. They felt Sariputta wielded too great an influence. When some bhikkhus were corrected by the Buddha, they mistakenly blamed Sariputta for pointing out their errors to the Buddha. Some bhikkhus felt almost a hatred for Sariputta. They were unable to forget that some years before, the Buddha had invited Sariputta to share his seat. Venerable Ananda recalled one monk named Kokalika, who had lived at Jetavana 8 years earlier. Kokalika hated Sariputta and Moggallana so much that not even the Buddha himself could persuade him otherwise. Kokalika said that Sariputta and Moggallana were both hypocrites whose actions were motivated by ambition. The Buddha met privately with him and said that these two elders were sincere and that their actions arose from loving kindness. But Kokalika's mind was filled with jealousy and hatred, and finally he left the monastery, joined the venerable Devadatta in Rajagaha, and became one of Devadatta's closest associates. It was because of these kinds of problems that Ananda had been reluctant to accept the responsibility of becoming the Buddha's attendant. Without the conditions he had suggested, such as not sleeping in the same room or sharing the same food with the Buddha, Ananda knew that many brothers would resent him also. Some brothers felt they did not receive enough of the Buddha's attention. Ananda knew that such feelings could lead to anger and hatred, and could even lead some to abandon the Buddha, their teacher. Ananda also recalled a woman in Kalmashadamya village in Kosambi named Magandika, who grew to hate the Buddha when she did not receive special attention from him. She was a beautiful Brahmana woman. 4 years old when she met him. She was immediately attracted to him, and as her feelings grew stronger, she longed to know if the Buddha felt any special regard for her. Magandika did everything she could to think of to receive his special attention, but the Buddha treated her as he did everyone else. In the end, her affections turned to hatred. When she later became the wife of King Udena Vatsa, she used her position and influence to spread rumors and insults about the Buddha. She even pressured the authorities into forbidding the Buddha to give public Dharma talks. When Samavati, a beloved concubine of King Udena, became a disciple of the Buddha, Magandika found ways to make her suffer. Disturbed by all of this, Ananda suggested to the Buddha that they leave Kosambi to spread the Dharma in a more hospitable place. The Buddha asked him, "If we go somewhere else and meet with insult and difficulty there too, what should we do?" Ananda replied, "Move on to some other place." The Buddha disagreed. "That would not be correct, Ananda. We must not become discouraged every time we meet with difficulty. Solutions should be sought in the very midst of hardship. Ananda, if we practice equanimity, we will not be bothered by insults and slander. The people who slander us cannot harm us. They only harm themselves. When a man spits at the sky is not sullied. The spit falls back in the face of the one who spat." Ananda had no worries about Sariputta's ability to deal with the present situation. Venerable Sariputta was rightfully trusted by the Buddha. He was a truly virtuous and worthy elder of the Sangha. Because of his deep insight, the Buddha depended on his help in guiding the Sangha. He was the author of several sutras, including the Hatipadopama Sutra, the Sutra on the Elephant's Footprints, in which he spoke about the relation of the four elements to the five aggregates in an original way, based on the fruits of his own practice. When the Buddha entered the Dharma hall, all the bhikkhus rose to their feet. He motioned for them to be seated again and then sat down himself. He motioned to Venerable Sariputta to sit on a low chair placed next to him. The Buddha spoke to Sariputta. A bhikkhu has accused you of knocking him down and not apologizing. Do you have anything to say about this? Venerable Sariputta stood and joined his palms. He bowed first to the Buddha and then to the community. He said, Lord, a monk who does not practice, who does not contemplate the body in the body, who is not mindful of the actions of the body, such a monk could knock down a fellow monk and leave him there without apologizing. Lord, I still remember the lesson you gave 14 years ago to Bhikkhu Rahula. He was only 18 years old at the time. You taught him to contemplate the nature of earth, water, fire, and air in order to nourish and develop the four virtues of loving-kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Although your teaching was directed at Rahula, I learned from it also. I have made efforts to observe that teaching throughout the past 14 years, and I have often thanked you inwardly. Lord, I have practiced to be more like earth. Earth is wide and open and has the capacity to receive and transform. Whether people toss pure and fragrant substances, such as flowers, perfume, or fresh milk upon the earth, or toss unclean and foul-smelling substances, such as excrement, urine, blood, mucus, and spit upon it, the earth receives it all equally, with neither grasping nor aversion. Lord, I have contemplated to make my body and mind more like the earth. A monk who does not contemplate the body in the body, who is not mindful of the actions of the body, such a monk could knock down a brother monk and leave him without apologizing. Such is not my way. Lord, I have practiced to be more like water. Whether someone pours fragrant substances or defiled substances into water, the water receives them both without grasping or aversion. Water is immense and flowing and has the capacity to transform and purify. Respected Buddha, I have contemplated to make my body and mind more like water. A monk who does not contemplate the body in the body, who is not mindful of the actions of the body, such a monk could knock down a brother monk and leave him without apologizing. Such is not my way. Lord, I have practiced to be more like fire. Fire burns all things, the beautiful as well as the impure, without grasping or aversion. Fire has the ability to burn, purify, and transform. Respected Buddha, I have contemplated to make my body and mind more like fire. A monk who does not contemplate the body in the body, who is not mindful of the actions of the body, such a monk could knock down a brother monk and leave him without apologizing. Such is not my way. Lord, I have practiced to be more like air. The air carries all manner of smells, good and bad, without grasping or aversion. Air has the capacity to transform, purify, and release. Respected Buddha, I have contemplated to make my body and mind become more like the air. A monk who does not contemplate the body in the body, who is not mindful of the actions of the body, such a monk could knock down a brother monk and leave him without apologizing. Such is not my way. Lord, like a small, untouchable child with tattered clothes who grasps a bowl and begs in the street for scraps of food, I practice to hold no false pride or arrogance. I have tried to make my heart like the heart of an untouchable child's heart. I have tried to practice humility, not daring to place myself higher than others. Respected Buddha, a monk who does not contemplate the body in the body, who is not mindful of the actions of the body, such a monk could knock down a brother monk and leave him without apologizing. Such is not my way. Venerable Sariputta was prepared to continue speaking, but his accuser could bear no more. He stood up and draped a corner of his Sangati robe over his shoulder, and then bowed to the Buddha. With his palms joined, he confessed, Lord Buddha, I have violated the precepts. I have borne false witness against Venerable Sariputta. I confess my transgression before you and the entire community. I vow to observe my precepts in the future. The Buddha said, It is good that you have confessed your transgression before the community. We accept your confession. Venerable Sariputta joined his palms and said, I bear no grudge against my brother, and I ask him to forgive anything I may have done to upset him in the past. The bhikkhu bowed to Sariputta with his palms joined. Sariputta returned his bow. Happiness filled the Dharma hall. Venerable Ananda stood up and said, Brother Sariputta, please stay with us for a few more days. Your brothers would welcome a chance to spend more time with you. Venerable Sariputta smiled his acceptance. With the retreat season over, the Buddha traveled to many villages in the countryside. One day he spoke in Kesaputta, a village that belonged to the Kalama clan. Many young people gathered to hear him. They had all heard about the monk Gautama, but this was the first opportunity they had to meet him in person. One young man joined his palms and spoke, Teacher, for a long time many Brahmana priests have come to Kesaputta in order to teach their various doctrines. Each priest claims that his doctrine is superior to other doctrines. This has confused us. We do not know which path to follow. In fact, we have lost faith in all the doctrines. We have heard that you are an enlightened master. Can you tell us whom we should believe and whom we should not? Who speaks the truth and who is merely spreading false doctrines? The Buddha answered, I can understand why you have given rise to doubts. Friends, do not be hasty to believe a thing even if everyone repeats it, or even if it is written in holy scripture or spoken by a teacher revered by the people. Accept only those things that accord with your own reason, things that the wise and virtuous support, things that in practice bring benefit and happiness. Abandon those things that do not accord with your own reason, that are not supported by the wise and virtuous, and which in practice do not bring benefit and happiness. The Kalamas asked the Buddha to tell them more. He said, Friends, suppose there is a person ruled by greed, anger, and ignorance. Will his greed, anger, and ignorance bring him happiness or suffering? The people answered, Master, greed, anger, and ignorance will cause such a person to commit acts that bring suffering to him and others. Is living by greed, anger, and ignorance supported by the wise and virtuous? No, Master. The Buddha continued, Take the example of someone who lives according to loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, who makes others happy by relieving their suffering, who rejoices over the good fortune of others, and who treats others without discrimination. Will such qualities bring that person happiness or suffering? Teacher, such qualities will bring happiness to the person and to all those around him. Are loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity supported and encouraged by the wise and virtuous? Yes, Master. My friends, you are already qualified to discern which things to accept and which things to discard. Believe and accept only those things that accord with your own reason, those things that are supported by the wise and virtuous, and those things that in practice bring benefit and happiness to yourselves and others. Discard things that oppose these principles. The Kalama youth were encouraged by the Buddha's words. They saw that his teaching did not require unconditional faith. The Buddha's way truly respected freedom of thought. Many of the Kalamas asked to be accepted by the Buddha as disciples that day. Chapter 63. All the Way to the Sea. During his travels, the Buddha stopped in the village of Alavi. The Buddha and 8 bhikkhus were offered a meal in a public building there, while all the local people were served food as well. Following the meal, the Buddha was about to begin a Dharma talk when an elderly farmer, almost out of breath, entered the hall. He was late because he'd had to search for a lost water buffalo. The Buddha could see that the old farmer had not eaten all day, and he asked that rice and curry be served to the old man before he would begin the Dharma talk. Many people felt impatient. They did not understand why one man should be allowed to hold up the Buddha's discourse. When the farmer was finished eating, the Buddha said, Respected friends, if I delivered a Dharma talk while our brother was still hungry, he would not be able to concentrate. That would be a pity. There is no greater suffering than hunger. Hunger wastes our bodies and destroys our well-being, peace, and joy. We should never forget those who are hungry. It is a discomfort to miss one meal, but think of the suffering of those who have not had a proper meal in days or even weeks. We must find ways to assure that no one in this world is forced to go hungry. After Alavi, the Buddha followed the Ganga northwest toward Kosambi. He paused to watch a piece of driftwood being carried downstream. He called to the other bhikkhus, pointed to the piece of wood, and said, "Bhikkhus, if that piece of driftwood does not become lodged against the riverbank, if it does not sink, if it does not become moored on a sandbar, if it isn't lifted out of the water, if it isn't caught in a whirlpool, or if it doesn't rot from the inside out, it will float all the way to the sea. It is the same for you on the path. If you don't become lodged against the riverbank, if you don't sink, if you don't become moored on a sandbar, if you're not lifted out of the water, if you don't become caught in a whirlpool, or if you don't rot from the inside out, you are certain to reach the great sea of enlightenment and emancipation." The bhikkhus said, "Please, Lord, explain this more fully. What does it mean to become lodged against the riverbank, to sink, or to be moored on a sandbar?" The Buddha answered, "To become lodged against the riverbank is to become entangled by the six senses and their objects. If you practice diligently, you will not become entangled in feelings, which result from contact between the senses and their objects. To sink means to become enslaved by desire and greed, which rob you of the strength needed to persevere in your practice. To become moored on a sandbar means to worry about serving only your own desires, forever seeking advantages and prestige for yourself while forgetting the goal of enlightenment. To be lifted from the water means to lose yourself in dispersion, loitering with people of poor character instead of pursuing the practice. To be caught in a whirlpool means to be bound by the five categories of desire, being caught by good food, sex, money, fame, or sleep. To rot from the inside out means to live a life of false virtue, deceiving the Sangha while using the Dharma to serve your own desires. Because if you practice diligently and avoid these six traps, you will certainly attain the fruit of enlightenment, just as that piece of driftwood will make it to the sea if it overcomes all obstacles." As the Buddha spoke these words to the bhikkhus, a youth tending water buffaloes nearby stopped to listen. His name was Nanda. He was so moved by the Buddha's words that he approached the bhikkhus and asked to be accepted as a disciple. He said, "Teacher, I want to be a bhikkhu like these brothers. I want to follow the spiritual path. I promise to devote myself to studying the way. I will avoid becoming caught against the riverbank, sinking, becoming moored on a sandbar, being lifted from the water, becoming caught in a whirlpool, and rotting from the inside out. Please accept me as a disciple." The Buddha was pleased by the young man's bright countenance. He knew the young man was capable and diligent, although he had probably had little or no schooling. The Buddha nodded his acceptance and asked, "How old are you?" Nanda answered, "Master, I am 16. "Are your parents living?" "No, Master, they are both dead. I have no other family. I take care of a rich man's water buffaloes in exchange for shelter." The Buddha asked, "Can you live on just one meal a day?" "I have been doing that already for a long time." The Buddha said, "In principle, you should be 20 years old before being accepted into the Sangha. Most young men are not mature enough to live the life of a homeless monk until they are at least 20. But you are clearly special. I will ask the community to waive the usual requirement in your case. You can practice as a Samanera novice for 4 years before taking the full precepts. Return the water buffaloes and ask your master's permission to leave his employment. We will wait here for you." The youth replied, "Master, I do not think that will be necessary. These buffaloes are very obedient. They will return to the stable on their own, even without my assistance." The Buddha said, "No, you must lead them back yourself and speak to your master before you can join us." "But what if you are gone by the time I return?" The Buddha smiled. "Do not worry. You have my word that we will wait here for you." While Nanda led the buffaloes back to their stable, the Buddha spoke with Svasti. "Svasti, I will place this young man under your care. I believe you understand best how to guide and support him." Svasti joined his palms and smiled. Venerable Svasti was 39 years old now, He knew why the Buddha wanted him to be young Nanda's instructor. Long ago, the Buddha delivered the Sutra on tending water buffaloes after being inspired by his friendship with Svasti when Svasti was a buffalo boy like Nanda. Svasti knew he could guide Nanda well on the path. He knew that his closest friend, Venerable Rahula, would assist him also. Rahula was now 36. Svasti's siblings were all grown with families of their own. The hut they once shared had long since perished. Svasti recalled with a smile the visit he made to Uruvela one year with Rahula. It was after Rupak had married and moved to another village. At that time, Bhima and Bala still lived together and supported themselves by making and selling cakes. Bhikkhus Svasti and Rahula walked to the Niranjara River. Svasti had not forgotten his promise to give Rahula the experience of riding on a water buffalo, and so he called to some young buffalo boys who were grazing their buffaloes near the riverbanks. He asked them to help Bhikkhu Rahula climb onto the back of one of the great beasts. At first Rahula hesitated, but then he removed his sangati and handed it to Svasti. Rahula was touched by how gentle the mighty beast was. He shared his impressions of the leisurely ride with Svasti, and he wondered aloud what the Buddha would think if he could see him. Svasti smiled. He knew that if Rahula had remained in the Sakya palace to one day become king, he would never have enjoyed this water buffalo ride. Svasti returned to the present moment just as young Nanda arrived. That night he shaved Nanda's hair and showed him how to wear the robe, carry the begging bowl, walk, stand, lie down, and sit as a mindful bhikkhu. Nanda was mature and diligent, and Svasti enjoyed helping him. He recalled how some years ago, 17 young people had been accepted into the Sangha at Bamboo Forest. The oldest boy, Upali, was 17, and the youngest only 12. They were all from wealthy families. When Upali asked his parents to allow him to become a bhikkhu, and they agreed, 16 of his friends implored their parents to let them do the same. Once they joined the Sangha, they were expected to follow the life of a bhikkhu, including eating only one meal before noon. The first night, several of the youngest boys cried from hunger. When the Buddha asked the next morning why he heard children crying in the night, he was told about the boys being accepted into the community. The Buddha said, "Henceforth, we will accept only young men who are at least 20 years of age into the Sangha. Children cannot be expected to live the life of a homeless monk." The boys were allowed to stay, but the Buddha asked that those 15 years old and younger be given an additional meal in the evening. All the boys remained bhikkhus. The youngest one, Svasti realized, was already 20 now. Chapter 64. The Round of Birth and Death. One day, while sitting in Bisakala Park in Susumaragiri, the Buddha spoke to the bhikkhus. "Bhikkhus, I want to tell you about the 8 realizations of great beings. Venerable Anuruddha has spoken about these 8 realizations before. They are the realizations taught by great beings to help others overcome forgetfulness and attain enlightenment. The first realization is the awareness that all dharmas are impermanent and without a separate self. By contemplating on the impermanent and non-self nature of all dharma, you can escape suffering and attain enlightenment, peace, and joy. The second realization is the awareness that more desire brings more suffering. All hardships in life arise from greed and desire. The third realization is the awareness that living simply, having few desires, leads to peace, joy, and serenity. Living simply allows for more time and concentration to practice the way and to help others. The fourth realization is the awareness that only diligent effort leads to enlightenment. Laziness and indulging in sensual desires are obstacles to the practice. The fifth realization is the awareness that ignorance is the cause of the endless round of birth and death. You must always remember to listen and learn in order to develop your understanding and eloquence. The sixth realization is the awareness that poverty creates hatred and anger, which in turn create a vicious cycle of negative thoughts and actions. Followers of the way, when practicing generosity, should consider everyone, friends and enemies alike, as equal, not condemning anyone's past wrongdoings or hating those who are presently causing harm. The seventh realization is the awareness that although we dwell in the world to teach and assist others, we should not become caught up in worldly matters. One who leaves home to follow the way possesses only three robes and a bowl. He always lives simply and looks at all beings with the eyes of compassion. The eighth realization is the awareness that we do not practice for our individual enlightenment alone, but devote our whole being to guiding all others to the gates of enlightenment. Bhikkhus, these are the eight realizations of the great beings. All great beings, thanks to these eight realizations, have attained enlightenment. Wherever they go in life, they use these eight realizations to open minds and educate others, so that everyone may discover the path that leads to enlightenment and emancipation. When he returned to Bamboo Forest in Rajagaha, the Buddha was informed that Bhikkhu Vakali was gravely ill and hoped to see the Buddha before he died. Vakali's attendant came to see the Buddha. After bowing three times, he said, "Lord, my teacher is very ill. He is staying in the home of a lay disciple who is a potter. He asked me to come bow before you in his place." The Buddha turned to Ananda and said, "We will go at once to visit Venerable Vakali." When he saw the Buddha enter the room, Bhikkhu Vakali made a great effort to sit up. "Please, Vakali," said the Buddha, "don't try to sit up. Ananda and I will sit close by the bed on these chairs." After he and Ananda were seated, the Buddha said, "Vakali, I hope your strength is improving and that the pains in your body are easing." "Lord, my strength is rapidly declining. I am most uncomfortable. The pains are growing more severe." "I hope then that you do not suffer from any worries or regrets." "Lord, I do suffer from worries and regrets." "I hope your regrets are not about violating your precepts." "No, Lord. I have observed my precepts fully and feel no shame." "What then do you worry about and regret?" "I regret that due to my illness, it has been a long time since I have been able to visit you." The Buddha gently scolded, "Vakali, do not worry about such things. You have lived a blameless life. That is what keeps teacher and student close. Do you think you need to see my face in order to see the Buddha? This body is not important. Only the teaching is important. If you can see the teaching, you can see the Buddha. If you can see this body but not the teaching, it is of no value at all." After a moment of silence, the Buddha asked, "Vakali, do you understand how impermanent the body is, mine as well as yours?" "Lord, I see that most clearly. The body is constantly being born, dying, and transforming. I see how feelings are also impermanent, constantly being born, dying, and transforming. Perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness follow the same law of birth and death. All are impermanent. Before your visit today, I contemplated deeply on the impermanent nature of the five skandhas. I have seen that there is nothing in the five rivers of form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, or consciousness that contains a separate self." "Wonderful, Vakali! I have faith in you. Nothing in the five skandhas contains a separate self. Open your eyes and look. Where is Vakali not present? What is not Vakali? The wonder of life is everywhere. Vakali, birth and death cannot touch you. Smile at your body comprised of the four elements. Smile even at the pain rising and falling in your body." Tears glistened in Vakali's eyes and he smiled. The Buddha stood up and took his leave. When the Buddha and Ananda were gone, Vakali asked his friends to carry him on his bed to Isagiri Mountain. He said, "How can someone like me die in a room? I want to die on the mountainside beneath the spacious skies." His friends carried him to Isagiri. That night, the Buddha meditated deep into the night. In the early hours of the morning, he told a number of bhikkhus he met near his hut, "Go visit Vakali and tell him there is nothing to fear. His death will be peaceful and blameless. Tell him to put his heart at rest. I have great faith in him." When the bhikkhus found Venerable Vakali at Isagiri, they told him they carried a message from the Buddha. Vakali said, "Please, friends, lift me off this bed and place me on the earth. How can I lie on a high bed while receiving the Lord Buddha's words?" They did as he asked, and then repeated the Buddha's words. Vakali joined his palms and said, "Please, brothers, when you return to the monastery, bow three times to the Buddha on my behalf, and tell him that Bhikkhu Vakali is deathly ill and in terrible pain. Vakali sees clearly that the five skandhas are impermanent and without a separate self. Vakali is no longer bound by the five skandhas. In his last moments, Vakali has released all fears and worries. The bhikkhu said, "Brother, ease your heart. We will return and bow three times to the Buddha and speak your last words to him." The bhikkhus were no sooner out of sight than Bhikkhu Vakali passed away. That afternoon, the Buddha climbed Isigiri with several bhikkhus. The blue sky was cloudless. Only a thin strand of smoke curled up into the sky from a hut at the foot of the mountain. It drifted for a moment and then vanished. Looking at the vast round sky, the Buddha said, "Vakali has been liberated. No delusion or phantom can disturb him now." The Buddha again traveled, this time to Nalanda and Vaishali. One day at the Kutagara monastery in the great woods, the Buddha told the bhikkhus, "As living beings, people have to suffer, more or less. However, those who devote themselves to the study and practice of the Dharma suffer much less than others, because they possess understanding, the fruit of their practice." That day it was still very hot, but the Buddha was seated with his bhikkhus in the shade of many beautiful sala trees. He picked up a small piece of earth, held it between his thumb and forefinger, and asked, "Bhikkhus, if we compare this piece of earth with Gayasisa Mountain, which is larger?" "Of course, Gayasisa is much larger, Lord." "It is like that, O bhikkhus. For those who have arrived at understanding, thanks to their study and practice of the Dharma, their suffering is almost nothing compared with the suffering of those who are submerged in ignorance. Ignorance magnifies suffering by millions of times. Bhikkhus, suppose someone is struck by an arrow. He will feel pain. But if a second arrow strikes him at the very same spot, the pain will be much more than just doubled. And if a third arrow strikes him at that same spot again, the pain will be 1,000 times more intense. Bhikkhus, ignorance is the second and the third arrow. It intensifies the pain. Thanks to understanding, a practitioner can prevent the pain in himself and others from being intensified. When an unpleasant feeling, physical or mental, arises in him, the wise man does not worry, complain, weep, pound his chest, pull his hair, torture his body and mind, or faint. He calmly observes his feeling and is aware that it is only a feeling. He knows that he is not the feeling, and he is not caught by the feeling. Therefore, the pain cannot bind him. When he has a painful physical feeling, he knows that there is a painful physical feeling. He does not lose his calmness, does not worry, does not fear, and does not complain. Thus, the feeling remains a painful physical feeling, and it is not able to grow and ravage his whole being. Bhikkhus, be diligent in your practice of looking deeply so that the fruit of understanding may arise, and you will no longer be bound by pain. Birth, sickness, old age, and death will also stop bothering you. When a bhikkhu is about to pass away, he should dwell in the contemplation of the body, the feelings, the mind, and the objects of mind. Every position and every act of the body should be placed under mindfulness. Every feeling should also be placed under mindfulness. The bhikkhu contemplates the nature of impermanence and the nature of interdependence of the body and of the feelings, so that he will not be bound by the body and the feelings, even pleasant ones. If he needs all his strength to bear the pain, he should only observe, "This is a kind of pain that needs all my strength to bear. This pain is not me. I am not this pain. I am not caught by this pain. The body and the feelings are, at this moment, like a lamp whose oil and wick are running out. It is by conditions that the light manifests or ceases to manifest. I am not bound by conditions. If a monk practices in this way, calmness and release will come." When the first rains began to relieve the summer heat, he returned to Jetavana for the retreat season. He taught the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis more about the law of dependent co-arising. One bhikkhu stood up and asked, "Lord, you have taught that consciousness is the basis of name and form. Does it then follow that the existence of all dharmas arises from consciousness?" The Buddha answered, "That is correct. Form is an object of consciousness. The subject and the object of consciousness are two faces of one reality. There can be no consciousness without the object of consciousness. Consciousness and the object of consciousness cannot exist independently of each other. Because the subject and object of consciousness cannot be separated, they are both said to arise from mind. Lord, if form arises from consciousness, consciousness can be said to be the source of the universe. Is it possible to know how consciousness or mind came to be? When did mind begin? Can one speak of the beginning of mind? Bhikkhus, the concepts of beginning and end are only mental constructs created by the mind. In truth, there is no beginning or end. We only think about beginnings and endings when we are trapped in ignorance. It is because of ignorance that people are caught in an endless round of birth and death. If the round of birth and death has no beginning and no end, how can one escape it? Birth and death are only concepts created out of ignorance. To transcend the thoughts of birth and death, and beginning and end, is to transcend the endless round. Because that is all I wish to say today. Practice looking deeply into all things. We will speak again about this subject on another day. Chapter 65. Neither full nor empty. After the Dharma talk, Venerable Sasti noticed how pensive many of the monks looked. He also felt that he had not grasped what the Buddha taught. He resolved to listen carefully to the elder disciples during their Dharma discussions. At the next Dharma talk, Venerable Ananda was asked by the monks to ask questions to the Buddha in front of the entire assembly. His first question was, Lord, what is meant by the world and the Dharmas? The Buddha said, Ananda, the world, Loka, is the collective whole of all things subject to change and dissolution. All dharmas are contained in the 18 realms, the 6 sense organs, the 6 sense objects, and the 6 sense consciousnesses. The 6 sense organs, as you know, are eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. The 6 sense objects are form, sound, smell, taste, touch, and objects of mind. The 6 sense consciousnesses are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and perceiving. There are no dharmas apart from the 18 realms. All 18 realms are subject to birth and death, to change and dissolution. That is why I have said that the world is the collective whole of all things that possess the nature of change and dissolution. Ananda then asked, Lord, you have often said that all dharmas are empty. What is meant by that? The Buddha said, Ananda, I have said that all dharmas are empty because all dharmas are without a separate self. None of the 6 sense organs, 6 sense objects, or 6 sense consciousnesses possess a separate individual self. Ananda said, Lord, you have said that the 3 gates of liberation are emptiness, signlessness, and aimlessness. You have said that all dharmas are empty. Is it because all dharmas are subject to change and dissolution that they are also empty? Ananda, I have spoken often about emptiness and the contemplation on emptiness. The contemplation on emptiness is a wondrous meditation which can help people transcend suffering, birth, and death. Today I will speak more on this contemplation. Ananda, we are all sitting together in the Dharma Hall. There are no markets, buffaloes, or villages inside the Dharma Hall. There are only bhikkhus sitting and listening to the Dharma. We can say that the hall is empty of all that is not here, and that it contains what is actually here. The Dharma Hall is empty of markets, buffaloes, and villages, but contains bhikkhus. Do you agree that that is correct?
Yes, Lord.
After the Dharma talk, we will all leave the Dharma Hall, and there will no longer be any bhikkhus here. At that moment, the Dharma Hall will be empty of markets, buffaloes, villages, and bhikkhus. Do you agree that that is so?
Yes, Lord.
At that moment, the Dharma Hall will be empty of all those things. Ananda, full always means full of something, and empty always means empty of something. The words full and empty have no meaning on their own.
Please, Lord, could you explain that more?
Consider this. Empty is always empty of something, such as empty of markets, buffaloes, villages, and bhikkhus. We cannot say that emptiness is something that exists independently. Fullness is the same. Full is always full of something, such as full of markets, buffaloes, villages, or bhikkhus. Fullness is not something that exists independently. At the present moment, we can say that the Dharma Hall is empty of markets, buffaloes, and villages.
As for all dharmas, if we say that all dharmas are full, what are they full of? If we say that all dharmas are empty, what are they empty of? Because the emptiness of all dharmas refers to the fact that all dharmas are empty of a permanent and unchanging self. That is the meaning of the emptiness of all dharmas. You know that all dharmas are subject to change and dissolution. Because of that, they cannot be said to possess a separate, independent self. Because empty means empty of self. Because there is no aggregate among the five aggregates that possesses a permanent, unchanging nature. All the aggregates of body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness are without a separate self. They do not possess a permanent and unchanging nature. A permanent and unchanging nature would be an essential self. Contemplating in order to see the absence of such an independent, separate self is contemplating emptiness. Ananda said, "All dharmas are without a self. This we understand. But then, Lord, do the dharmas actually exist?" The Buddha quietly looked down at the small table before him on which was placed a bowl of water. He pointed to the bowl and asked Ananda, "Ananda, would you say this bowl is full or empty?" "Lord, the bowl is full of water." "Ananda, take this bowl outside and empty all the water out of it." Venerable Ananda did as the Buddha instructed. When he returned, he placed the empty bowl back on the table. The Buddha lifted the bowl and turned it upside down. He asked, "Ananda, is this bowl now full or empty?" "Lord, it is no longer full. It is empty." "Ananda, are you sure the bowl is empty?" "Yes, Lord, I am sure the bowl is empty." "Ananda, this bowl is no longer full of water, but it is full of air." "You have forgotten already. Empty means empty of something, and full means full of something. In this case, the bowl is empty of water, but full of air." "I understand now." "Good. Ananda, this bowl can be either empty or full. Of course, whether there is emptiness or fullness depends on the presence of the bowl. Without a bowl, there would be no emptiness or fullness. It is just like the Dharma hall. In order for it to be full or empty, it must first be there." "Ah!" the bhikkhus suddenly exclaimed with one voice. Venerable Ananda joined his palms. "Lord, then the dharmas do exist. The dharmas are real." The Buddha smiled. "Ananda, don't be caught by words. If the dharmas are phenomena empty of self, their existence is not the existence of ordinary perception. Their existence has the same meaning as emptiness." Ananda joined his palms. "Please, Lord, can you explain that further?" "Ananda, we have spoken about an empty and full bowl. We have also spoken about an empty and full Dharma hall. I have briefly spoken about emptiness. Let me speak more about fullness. Although we have agreed that the bowl on the table is empty of water, if we look deeply, we will see that it is not entirely true." The Buddha lifted the bowl and then looked at Ananda. "Ananda, among the interwoven elements that have given rise to the bowl, do you see water?"
"Yes, Lord. Without water, the potter would not have been able to mix the clay he used to fashion the bowl."
"Just so, Ananda. Looking deeply, we can see the presence of water in the bowl, even though we earlier stated that it is empty of water. The presence of the bowl depends on the presence of water. Ananda, can you see the fire element in this bowl?"
"Yes, Lord. Fire was necessary to complete the bowl. Looking deeply, I can see the presence of heat and fire in the bowl."
"What else can you see?"
"I see the air.
Without air, the fire could not have burned and the potter could not have lived. I see the potter and his skillful hands. I see his consciousness. I see the kiln and the wood stacked in the kiln. I see the trees the wood came from. I see the rain, sun, and earth which enabled the trees to grow. Lord, I can see thousands of interpenetrating elements that gave rise to this bowl."
"Excellent, Ananda. Contemplating the bowl, it is possible to see the interdependent elements that gave rise to the bowl.
Ananda, these elements are present within and without the bowl. Your own awareness is one of the elements. If you took away heat and returned it to the sun, if you returned the clay to the earth and the water to the river, if you returned the potter to his parents and the wood to the forest trees, could the bowl still exist?"
"Lord, the bowl could no longer exist.
If you return the interdependent elements that gave rise to the bowl to their sources, the bowl could no longer be present."
"Ananda, contemplating the law of dependent co-arising, we see that the bowl cannot exist independently. It can only exist in interdependent relation with all other dharmas. All dharmas depend on each other for birth, existence, and death. The presence of one dharma implies the presence of all other dharmas. The presence of all dharmas is implied by the presence of just one dharma. Ananda, this is the principle of interpenetration and interbeing. Ananda, interpenetration means that within this, that is, and within that, this is. For example, when we look at this bowl, we can see the potter. And when we look at the potter, we can see the bowl. Interbeing means that this is that, and that is this. For example, waves are water, and water is waves. Ananda, at present, there are no markets, buffaloes, or villages in the Dharma Hall. But that is only from one viewpoint. In reality, without the presence of markets, buffaloes, and villages, this Dharma Hall could not exist. Thus, Ananda, when you look at the empty Dharma Hall, you should be able to see the presence of markets, buffaloes, and villages. Without this, that is not. The basic meaning of emptiness, sunatta, is this is because that is. The bhikkhus listened in perfect silence. The Buddha's words made a deep impression on them. After a brief pause, the Buddha lifted the empty bowl again and said, Bhikkhus, this bowl cannot exist independently. It is here thanks to all the things we consider non-bowl entities, such as earth, water, fire, air, potter, and so forth. It is the same for all dharmas. Every dharma exists in interdependent relation to all other dharmas. All dharmas exist by the principles of interpenetration and interbeing. Bhikkhus, look deeply at this bowl, and you can see the entire universe. This bowl contains the entire universe. There is only one thing the bowl is empty of, and that is a separate individual self. What is a separate individual self? It is a self that exists completely on its own, independent of all other elements. No dharma can exist independently from other dharmas. No dharma possesses a separate essential self. That is the meaning of emptiness. Empty means empty of self. Bhikkhus, the five aggregates are the basic elements of a person. Form does not contain a self, because form cannot exist independently. Within form exist feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. It is the same for feelings. Feelings do not possess a self because feelings cannot exist independently. Within feelings are form, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. The same is true for the other three aggregates. No aggregate possesses a separate identity. The five aggregates depend on each other in order to exist. Thus, the five aggregates are all empty. Because the six sense organs, the six sense objects, and the six sense consciousnesses are all empty. Every sense organ, every sense object, and every sense consciousness depends on all other sense organs, sense objects, and sense consciousnesses in order to exist. No sense organ, sense object, or sense consciousness possesses an independent separate nature. Because let me repeat this so that it will be easy for you to remember. This is, therefore that is. All dharmas depend on each other in order to exist. Thus, all dharmas are empty. Empty here means empty of an independent, separate self. Venerable Ananda said, Lord, some Brahmana scholars and leaders of other religious sects claim that the monk Gautama teaches nihilism. They say that you lead people to negate all of life. Do they misunderstand you because you say that all dharmas are empty? The Buddha answered, Ananda, the Brahmana scholars and leaders of other religious sects do not speak correctly about this. I have never taught the doctrine of nihilism. I have never led others to deny life. Ananda, among false views, there are two that entangle people the most. Views of being and views of non-being. The first view regards all things as having a separate and permanent self-nature. The second regards all things as illusions. If you are caught in either view, you cannot see the truth. Ananda, once Bhikkhu Kakayana asked me, Lord, what is false view and what is right view? I answered that false view is to be caught in either the notion of being or the notion of non-being. When we see into the true nature of reality, we are no longer bound by either of these views. A person with right view understands the process of birth and death in all dharmas. Because of that, he is not disturbed by thoughts of existence or non-existence. When suffering arises, the person with right view knows that suffering arises. When suffering fades, the person with right view knows that suffering is fading. The arising and fading of all dharmas does not disturb the person with right view. The two false views of permanence and illusion are too extreme. Dependent co-arising transcends both extremes and dwells in the middle. Ananda, being and non-being are concepts that do not accord with reality. Reality transcends the boundaries of such concepts. An enlightened person is one who has transcended the concepts of being and non-being. Ananda, not only are being and non-being empty, but birth and death are also empty. They are also merely concepts. Venerable Ananda asked, Lord, if birth and death are empty, why have you often said that all dharmas are impermanent, constantly being born and dying? Ananda, at the relative conceptual level, we speak of dharmas being born and passing away. But from the point of view of the Absolute, all dharmas are by nature birthless and deathless. Please, Lord, explain this. Ananda, take the example of the Bodhi tree you planted in front of the Dharma hall. When was it born? Lord, it was born 4 years ago at the very moment the seed put forth roots. Ananda, before that, did the Bodhi tree exist? No, Lord. Before that, there was no Bodhi tree. Do you mean to say that the Bodhi tree arose from nothing? Can any Dharma come into being from nothing? Venerable Ananda fell silent. The Buddha continued, Ananda, there is no Dharma in all the universe that can come into being from nothing. Without the seed, there could be no Bodhi tree. The Bodhi tree owes its existence to the seed. The tree is the continuation of the seed. Before the seed penetrated roots into the earth, the Bodhi tree was already present in the seed. If a Dharma is already present, how can it be born? The Bodhi tree's nature is without birth. The Buddha asked Ananda, After the seed penetrated roots into the earth, did the seed die? Yes, Lord. The seed died in order to give birth to the tree. Ananda, the seed did not die. To die means to pass from existence to non-existence. Is there any Dharma in all the universe that can pass from existence to non-existence? A leaf, a mote of dust, a trail of incense smoke. None of these can pass from existence to non-existence. All of these dharmas transform into different dharmas, that is all. The Bodhi seed is the same. The seed did not die. It transformed into a tree. The seed and the tree are both birthless and deathless. Ananda, the seed and the tree, you, me, the bhikkhus, the dharma hall, the leaf, a dust mote, a trail of incense smoke, all are without birth and death. Ananda, all dharmas are without birth and death. Birth and death are only mental concepts. All dharmas are neither full nor empty, neither created nor destroyed, neither defiled nor immaculate, neither increasing nor decreasing, neither coming nor going, neither one nor many. All these are merely concepts. Thanks to the contemplation on the empty nature of all dharmas, it is possible to transcend all discriminating concepts and realize the true nature of all things. Ananda, the true nature of all things is that there is neither full nor empty, birth nor death, becoming nor dissolving. It is based on that true nature that the world of birth and death, fullness and emptiness, becoming and dissolving arises. If not, how could there be a way out of birth and death, fullness and emptiness, becoming and dissolving? Ananda, have you ever stood on the seashore and watched the waves rise and fall on the surface of the sea? Birthlessness and deathlessness are like the water. Birth and death are like the waves. Ananda, there are long waves and short waves, high waves and low waves. Waves rise and fall, but the water remains. Without water, there could be no waves. The waves return to water. Waves are water. Water is waves. Though the waves may rise and pass away, If they understand that they themselves are the water, they will transcend notions of birth and death. They will not worry, fear, or suffer because of birth and death. Because the contemplation on the empty nature of all dharmas is wondrous. It leads to liberation from all fear, worry, and suffering. It will help you transcend the world of birth and death. Practice this contemplation with all your being. The Buddha was finished speaking. Venerable Sasti had never heard the Buddha speak more profoundly or wondrously. The eyes and smiles of the Buddha's senior disciples radiated happiness. Sasti felt he understood the Buddha's words, but had not penetrated their deepest meaning. He knew that Ananda would repeat the entire Dharma talk in the coming days. He would then have an opportunity to learn more by listening to the senior disciples discuss what the Buddha had said. Chapter 66. Four Mountains. Chapter 66. Four Mountains. Early one morning, Venerable Moggallana came to the Buddha, his eyes filled with tears. The Buddha asked him, what was the matter? And Moggallana answered, Lord, last night during my meditation, my thoughts turned to my mother. I contemplated on my feelings for her. I know when I was young, I sometimes caused her sorrow, but that is not the source of my pain. My pain arises from the knowledge that I was unable to help my mother while she was still alive, nor can I help her in death. Lord, my mother's karma is heavy. She committed many crimes during her life, and I am sure that her bad karma follows her and continues to make her suffer. During my meditation, I saw my mother, thin as a ghoul, in a dark, foul place. There was a bowl of rice nearby, and I offered it to her. But when she placed the rice in her mouth, it turned into live coals, and she had to spit it out in pain. Lord, this image will not leave me. I don't know how I can lighten her bad karma and help her to find release. The Buddha asked, what crimes did she commit when she was alive? Moggallana answered, Lord, she did not practice respect for life. Her work required her to kill many creatures. She did not practice right speech. Her words were often sources of suffering to others. She was like someone who rips up living trees and plants dead ones in their place. I dare not recount all her transgressions. It is enough to say that she violated all five of the wonderful precepts. Lord, I would endure any suffering to reverse my mother's karma. Please, Lord, in your compassion, tell me what I might do. The Buddha said, Moggallana, I am deeply moved by your love for your mother. The debt of gratitude we owe our parents is as wide as the sky and as deep as the sea. A child should never forget that debt of gratitude day and night. In times when there are no Buddhas or holy persons, parents should serve as Buddhas and holy persons. Moggallana, you did your best to help your mother while she was still living. Your concern continues now that she has died. This shows how deep your love is. I am happy to see that. Moggallana, the most important way to offer tribute to one's parents is by living a life of happiness and virtue. That is the best way to repay our debt of gratitude and to fulfill our parents' aspirations for us. Your life, Moggallana, is such a life. Your life of peace and joy, happiness and virtue serves as a model to others. You have helped many people find the path. Offer your life and good merit on behalf of your mother, and her karma can be transformed. Moggallana, I have a suggestion to help your mother. On Pavarana Day, the last day of the retreat season, ask the entire community to join you in a transformation ceremony for your mother to pray and transfer our merits to her. Many monks in our Sangha possess deep concentration and virtue. Their energy of transformation and their prayers joined with yours will be most powerful. Thanks to that, your mother's bad karma will dissolve, and she will have a chance to enter the path of true Dharma. I am sure there are others in our Sangha with similar situations. We should organize this ceremony on behalf of everyone's parents. Arrange with Sariputta to hold a special transformation ceremony on Pavarana Day on behalf of all parents, those who have died and those who are still living. This will also provide a good occasion to teach young people about the gratitude we owe our parents and ancestors. Moggallana, most people only appreciate their parents after they've already died. Having parents is a great happiness. Parents can be a source of great joy for their children. Children should cherish their parents while they are still alive, truly seeing them and finding ways to make them happy. Whether parents are alive or have passed away, loving actions can bring them happiness and share good merit with them. Helping the poor and infirm, visiting the lonely, freeing prisoners, releasing animals destined for the butcher, planting trees, these are all compassionate actions that can transform the present situation and bring happiness to our parents. On Pavarana Day, we will encourage everyone to perform these kinds of acts. Deeply comforted, Moggallana bowed to the Buddha. That afternoon, after his walking meditation, the Buddha met King Pasenadi at the monastery gates. As they exchanged greetings, seven ascetics from the Nagantha sect passed by. Ascetics in their sect wore no clothes, practiced austerities, did not shave their beards or cut their hair, and did not cut their nails. The king excused himself from the Buddha and approached the ascetics. He bowed respectfully and said, "Respected monks of high virtue, I am Pasenadi, king of Kosala." He bowed to them two more times, repeating the same words, before he returned to the Buddha's side. After they were out of sight, he asked the Buddha, "Lord, according to you, have any of those ascetics yet attained arhatship? Are any of them close to attaining such fruits?" The Buddha answered, "Your Majesty, you live the life of a ruler, and thus are more accustomed to men of government and politics. It is only natural that you would find it difficult to ascertain which monks have attained certain levels of spiritual practice. But in fact, it is difficult for anyone to know whether or not someone is enlightened after merely meeting them once or twice. It is necessary to live close to them, observing them carefully to see how they respond to difficult circumstances, to see how they converse with others, and to understand the depth of their wisdom, virtue, and attainment." The king understood. He said, "Lord, it is similar to when I send spies to investigate situations in other places. They disguise themselves so they will not be recognized. Often when they return to the palace, even I do not recognize them until they have discarded their disguises and washed their faces." "Yes, I see you are correct. Unless you know someone in depth, you cannot understand the depth of their virtue, wisdom, and attainment." The Buddha invited the king to walk with him to his hut. When they arrived, the Buddha asked Ananda to put out chairs. The king confided to the Buddha, "Lord, I am now 70 years old. I want to devote more time to spiritual studies. I feel I should do more sitting and walking meditation than I have in the past. But Lord, palace affairs are most time-consuming and demanding. Sometimes when I come to your Dharma talks, I am so tired I cannot keep my eyes open. I feel so ashamed. Lord, I am also guilty of overindulgence in food. One day I came to the monastery after eating entirely too much. It made me sleepy, and I went for a walk in hopes that walking meditation would clear my mind. But I grew more and more sleepy. I did not even notice you were standing on the same path, and I bumped right into you. Do you remember?" The Buddha laughed. "Yes, I remember, Your Majesty." "Majesty, simply eat less. Doing so will make your mind and body feel lighter, which will improve your ability to perform both your work of governing and your spiritual practice. You might ask Queen Malika or Princess Vajiri to help you by supervising your daily meals. They could serve you smaller quantities, still paying attention to the quality of nutrition." The king joined his palms to accept the Buddha's suggestion. The Buddha continued, "It is good to devote more time to looking after your health and pursuing your spiritual practice. Not much time remains for you in this life. Majesty, suppose a trusted messenger brought you news that a mighty mountain, high as the sky, was approaching from the east, crushing every living thing in its path. Just as you begin to worry about this situation, another trusted messenger brings news that a mighty mountain is advancing from the west, also crushing everything in its path. Then messengers from the north and south arrive bearing similar messages. Four mountains are advancing toward the capital, crushing every being in their paths. You know that you cannot escape. There is nothing you can do to prevent the mountains from coming. Your time is short. What would Your Majesty do?" The king pondered for a moment and then said, "Lord, I believe there is only one thing I could do. That would be to live my remaining hours in as worthy and serene a way as possible, following the true teaching." The Buddha praised the king. "Yes, Your Majesty, those four mountains are the mountains of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Old age and death are closing in on us, and we can never escape.
The king joined his palms. Lord, remembering that old age and death are approaching, I understand that the best thing I can do is to live my remaining days and months according to your teaching, living serenely and mindfully, and benefiting others, including the future generations. The king stood up and bowed to the Buddha before taking his leave. That rainy season, many Brahmins and members of different religious sects gathered in Savatthi. They organized sermons, lectures, and debates throughout the region, inviting people from the city to attend. At the debates, different sects were given a chance to expound their doctrines. Several of the Buddha's lay disciples attended some of these debates. They told the Buddha and the bhikkhus what they had seen and heard. They said that every metaphysical problem imaginable was presented, and that every speaker considered his doctrine the only correct one. The debates began cordially, but often ended in angry shouting matches. The Buddha told his disciples the following fable. Once upon a time, a clever king invited several people blind from birth to visit the palace. He brought out an elephant and asked them to touch it and then describe what the elephant was like. The blind man who rubbed its leg said that the elephant was like the pillars of a house. The man who stroked its tail said the elephant was like a feather duster. The person who touched its ears said that it was like a winnowing basket, and the man who touched its stomach said it was like a round barrel. The person who rubbed its head said the elephant was like a large earthenware jar, and the person who touched its tusk said the elephant was like a stick. When they sat to discuss what the elephant was like, no one could agree with anyone else, and a very heated argument arose. Because what you see and hear comprises only a small part of reality. If you take it to be the whole of reality, you will end up having a distorted picture. A person on the path must keep a humble, open heart, acknowledging that his understanding is incomplete. We should devote constant effort to study more deeply in order to make progress on the path. A follower of the way must remain open-minded, understanding that attachment to present views as if they were absolute truth will only prevent us from realizing the truth. Humility and open-mindedness are the two conditions necessary for making progress on the path.